Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Hi there, and welcome to the Smart Family Podcast. Today, we are thrilled to welcome back Craig Brannon. He's been with us twice before. He was episode 4 and episode 22. And I guess, Rob, he's getting to be a regular on our show.
Yeah, no kidding. But I'm excited about that.
Oh, absolutely. We love talking to Craig on the topic of his expertise, which is shame. And I think one of the reasons we want to come back to this topic is that, you know, as a parent, you tend to parent the way you were parented. You know, we tend to have generational cycles. And so where shame shows up in our parenting, we really want to be aware of it. And I think that's one of the huge values that Craig brings to our conversations on parenting and even our conversations on marriage. And so, Rob, how have you seen, you know, generational influences in your life?
Oh, yeah, no, good question, Tony. I mean, I often try to sort of be cognizant of that and say like, hey, you know, the way I'm relating to my kids or to my spouse, Rose, is that what I learned or was modeled for me when I was growing up as a kid in my family? And certainly it does show up. I mean, how can it not, right? And so, I mean, for example, my family is Dutch. We are from Holland. And, you know, one characteristic of a lot of Dutch families is that they just tend to be very matter of fact and blunt. And Rose jokes right. about it with me sometimes. And sometimes I do something or I say something where, you know, I get the look and it's sort of like, that is just like your dad, Rob. So
it that doesn't always sound up. Like a compliment.
No, you know, oftentimes, you know, it is just a coincidence that it sounds very similar, but Rose picks up on it and we kind of joke more about it than anything else. But, you know, of course, it's definitely something that I talk about with a lot of the families that sit across from me in my office. I often hear from, you know, mothers and fathers saying, well, that's how my, you know, dad treated me, or that's how, you know, my mom was towards me. And so, yeah, I bring that to my own kids in this generation. And when those are good characteristics and good parenting skills, then fantastic, great, carry that on. You know, but when they are less, you know, or where they are, where more maladaptive or negative, then maybe it's time to intentionally make some changes from our previous generation and move into a different direction, you know, because we aren't necessarily predestined to kind of carry on the same negative things from our previous generation into our current generation, right? So
exactly.
how can we get better? How can we improve? That should always be on our minds.
Yeah. We're like-minded on that, Rob. I think where, you know, where there are patterns or cycles that that should be broken, often it's just a matter of us being aware. You know, sometimes we're not even really aware of, you know, how we're speaking, our choice of words, the tone we're using, you know, is having an impact. And so just being able to stand back and have a look and think about it is so helpful.
Absolutely.
So Craig Brannon he's a counselor who works in Orillia, Ontario. He's got a practice called Next Step Counseling. He's got over 30 years of professional experience and 2 PhDs in the area of shame that he obtained from the University of South Africa. And so now we just love to get into our conversation with Craig Brannon about shame and parenting and marriage. Craig, we wanted to talk about shame today and parenting in particular to start off with. And I know that some of us were raised in environments where shaming was a technique. It was a way for parents to assert power, to keep control. Can you give us some concrete examples of ways that parents act or things that they say that do cause shame in kids?
Sure. So let's do a quick definition of what shame is. Shame is, and we all have shame naturally inside of us. That's important to understand. But shame then is the exposing someone as defective or flawed, and then pointing out those defects in that individual. Because shame is the desire to hide or to cover what I know is flawed in me. And so parents literally can shame their children in a number of ways, invalidating. So that can be, they can invalidate stressful situations. Oh, don't be a baby, or stop crying. Demeaning or labeling, which would be calling somebody a name, attributing negative traits of one parent to a child. Oh, you're just like your father, or you're just like your mother. Prophesying a child will be failure. You know, you're never going to mount to anything in my eyes. Not allowing the child to do things for themselves, interesting enough. That can be a shaming, because you communicate, you know, you'll just never cope. Without me, you'll just never cope. You'll never get it right. Tone is a way that we can shame our child in a way that we could demean them. Or they could say things like, oh, you want to do that again? Or, well, let's not give Susie the glass, because we know what happened last time. She broke it. That's another way of shaming. Another interesting way is a failure at working through family conflict in mature ways. We can shame a child by sweeping things under the carpet. Oh, that didn't happen. Or no, you just don't understand it. Or another one is comparing. You know, when I was your age, we didn't have that. We never got it like that way. You have it so easy, you people. Another way is critical of a child's choice. I cannot believe you chose to wear those clothes. I can't believe you made that decision. Those are ways that we can shame. A great example of that as well, I encourage every listener to watch the movie Tangled. It was a Disney movie. Mm-hmm. And the mother in there actually shames the child through emotional blackmail. And I took the lyrics down, and I went down the lyrics and showed how many times she actually shames the child just in that song. I'm going to give you just a real quick example. She says to her, you go outside? Why, Rapunzel, look at you. You're as fragile as a flower. Still a little sapling, like a sprout. You know why we stay in this tower, don't you? I knew that sooner or later you would have to leave the nest, but it's a scary world out there. One way or another, something will go wrong, I swear. And then she goes, go ahead, get trampled like a rhino. Go ahead, get mugged and left alone. Go ahead, leave me, I deserve it. Let me die here alone, be my guest. Although mother knows best. And then she says this to her, mother knows best, take it from your mumsy. On your own, you'll never survive. You're sloppy, undressed, immature and clumsy. Please, they'll eat you up alive. You're gullible, naive, positively grubby, ditzy and a bit, well, vague. Plus, I believe getting kind of chubby. And I'm just saying it because I love you. Mommy understands. Mumsy is here to help you. All I have is one request. Don't ever leave this tower again. Don't forget it. You'll regret it. Mother knows best.
Mm. Wow, what an example of being dismissive, but also so much guilt packed in there.
Yes,
I mean, there's so much of trying to guilt the child into meeting the parent's needs.
Well, Susan Forward wrote a book, Emotional Blackmail, and she has this beautiful acronym for how parents actually shame their kids, F-O-G. It literally creates a fog that the children have to struggle through. Fear, planting fear in the child. O, overwhelming them with negativity and shaming them and flooding them. So what happens is it cuts off the front of the brain, and it literally emotionally abuses them and overwhelms them with high cortisol levels. And then G is guilting mm-hmm. them, F-O-G. Mm-hmm. And it creates a fog for the child that they can't maneuver through without the help of the parent. So then the parent then gaslights them, because the child comes back and says, well, dad, mom, you said this and this. Oh, no, I never said that. Oh, you're right. Exaggerating. So I call it F-O-G-G, fog, because I add on. So it's fearing the child, overwhelming them, guilting them. But then when the child questions, gaslighting them. I never said that. Oh, you. So it further abuses emotionally and shames the child.
Absolutely. And Craig, you know, and the sad thing is that many of those kids will then grow up to be parents who parent that way themselves. And it's repeated generation after generation. I mean, we often say we parent how we were parented.
Right.
And that's not to blame. I mean, that's almost more to explain. I mean, that's just how nature and nurture works.
Right.
And so, but, you know, ultimately, don't we want to try and break that cycle? How can we break that cycle of shame and guilt? Where does that start?
Well, the first way is that you identify what that baseline is. What is a secure attachment? And the seven critical components or needs or requirements for a secure base. First is proximity maintenance, that I choose. These are all choices. I choose to be close. I choose to be present. I choose to be consistent. Second is predictability, that the child, I give the child an anticipatory experience for connection, but also a anticipatory experience that when I'm wrong, I'll admit my failure. I'll admit that I'm learning too, that daddy makes mistakes, mommy makes mistakes. Three, a secure base. Children need to know that when they're exploring their world, they can come back to their parents, that their parent will be a secure base, not a perfect base, but a secure base, that they'll intentionally initiate working things through with their children. Number four, a safe haven. Children need to know that there's an unconditional bond of safety. There's an unconditional emotional bond of safety. Number five, emotional attunement, that when the children return, that the parent's going to try and understand what emotions are, then define what the emotion is the child is going through with their child, and then work through that, showing empathy, saying, I can see you're frustrated at that, or you're angry at that. Define that for me. Let's talk that through. Number six, identifying the needs of the child, which become really the foundation to help a child understand their values. So looking at what the child needs, but individually, and I know that's tough if you have five kids, but you realize that each of the children are individual children and get to understand what their needs are and also how they might demand. Show me a demanding child, I'll show you a child whose needs are not being met. And then number seven, here's key, develop resiliency and perseverance. Work with the child. And as a family, the children need to see how they work through pain. On my daughter's wedding 3 years ago, this was her speech. She looked at her mother and she had a whole lot of accolades for her mom. Then she looked at me. She says, Dad, thank you for admitting where you were wrong. Thank you for loving mom. And thank you for working through your shame and your pain. Thank you for being real. And that's it. I have nothing else to say. Mm-hmm. You know, and to me, that was so key. That helped me to heal a little bit inside, you know, and so being able to break the cycle is, there's the baseline. Then identify, the key is then identify what are my insecure attachments. Then also define what emotions do I just not understand? How do I break the cycle? It's understanding the man or the woman in the mirror. Where have I failed? And here's the key. Where have I failed is different than saying you're a failure. No. I'm not a failure. I failed. I've been a disappointment, but I'm not a disappointment. There's a big difference.
Right.
So I look at and I confess those things. And then another area is to look at my own schemas, how my brain neurologically was shaped based upon my own maladaptive schemas or internal working models or thinking patterns growing up. And so when someone can get counsel at that level, then go back to their family and come across in a humble and teachable way, children respond to that.
Yeah.
They do respond to that. And I'm a classic example of being able to get it right, even though there's consequence that I'm still living. But that resilience, that perseverance to work that through, that is critical.
Craig, for the parent who's listening to all you have to say right now and realizes that in their own childhood experience, they didn't have a parent who noticed how they were feeling, or like you said, you know, don't cry. Why are you crying? you know, grow up, don't worry about that. No, don't feel that way. Why are you feeling that way? You shouldn't. You know, all of those responses to emotions that are really counterproductive. Like, how did you as a parent make the, you know, that switch go off where you could start to respond to your child's emotions and validate them?
The key was for me to understand emotional intelligence. You know, a lot of the body of research that I have that I did for the PhD looked at emotional intelligence in the workplace. What I realized is that there was no major tools out there to help parents work through their own emotions and that of their children. A lot of understanding others is understanding myself. Putting myself empathically, so empathic as it means to enter into the suffering of another, realizes that whether I like it or not, people say, well, just think it through. Well, no, I need to understand what that emotion is or emotions and then define it. A good way is to look back at where as a child and a teenager that our own parents didn't validate our emotions. Then I have clients write those emotions down, and then we start to define what does those emotions mean. So we'll go online and look at, you know, Collins dictionary or Webster's dictionary online. And then we'll use that word, let's say invalidation. Okay, write down invalidate. And then that means not to be valued. It means to be dismissed. Okay, in what ways did your parents dismiss you? In what ways are you dismissing your children?
Yeah.
You know, that correlation is so key, because to be able to say to a child or a teenager, you know, I've never parented a 12-year-old before, and I was once 12. And you know what? Again, not to blame grandma and grandpa. They didn't know. They didn't have the tools that I have now. But wow, I was invalidated. I can see how I invalidate you. I devalue and don't allow you to get frustrated or to fail or et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so talk to the child about that. Interesting, children respond to that.
Yeah, in doing this podcast now for almost a year, the theme that comes up over and over again, Craig, is get to know yourself. Know who you are, know your personality, know how you respond in times of stress and security. And the second theme that we hear about all the time is become a student of your child. Know your child, really be intentional about it. This is, you know, it comes natural to some extent, but if you really want to thrive, you know, do it intentionally, spend time doing this. Craig, would you say that there's a time though, that obviously there's a more critical time, the earlier on we can do this, the better, but we're going to have parents listening to this who are like, I got teenagers now, or my kids have grown up. Is there still any use in doing this? Or is there a certain time where it's like, it's too late, you know, your influence has dwindled?
We adopted a child, Gary. His mom was murdered by Robert Picton, the BC pig farmer. And he came to us when he was 12, 13. And I did not do a good job. I didn't know how to handle a child in trauma and in crisis. He left us and went back to BC. But he returned about 3 years ago, and he knocked at my door and he says, you're my dad. I need help. Well, and I started working with him. We actually fostered his baby this last year and handed the baby back, and he's doing great. And he sent me a card recently saying, you are my dad. And he's now 25. My other son, who's turning 26, returned to me last year saying, you have changed. And I just kept on loving him. I kept admitting my faults. I wrote down on a piece of paper where I failed 54 things I thought I did wrong as a parent. My other daughter, who's doing very well, she looked at it and she goes, think you're a little bit punitive, Dad. You did 10 of them. So, but there was still 10, you know. Yeah. So it was really neat to have to face and be broken and humbled before God and before my family and before my wife and say, here's where I failed and here's how we get it right. So, no, it's never too late. It's never too late. Here's why it's too late for people, because of their shame. Again, and in fairness, they've got to have counseling where we're going to unpack these areas of where we failed and humbly admit to those we fail. But that's part of life. That's part of resilience. We only grow through failure. Why? Because failure, in failing, we find meaning. We find purpose when we can define where we failed. But we live in a culture that Botoxes it, nip and tucks or numbs it by some way, or addictions. So we never, you know, as it all say with Gabor Mate says, show me addiction, I'll show you pain. And in that pain, it's often relational pain.
Yeah. Craig, it sounds like you've become comfortable with identifying where you failed or disappointed people, and you're willing to admit that it's helped you.
100%. And that's what I do for a living. I literally help people look at the complexity of their own dysfunction, their dark side. Because only when you look at your dark side is the healing. And those scars are not bad. Scarring is good if deep surgery is taking place. See, mm-hmm. I can pay a counselor for 2-3 hours, you know, 3 times a week if I wanted to say what my itching ears want to hear. But I don't want to, if I have cancer, I don't want a doctor to put a Winnie the Pooh Band-Aid or, as my little daughter wants, an Elsa Band-Aid over the cancer. I want them to do deep surgery.
Yeah. No, sometimes mm-hmm. we warn patients and clients that when you start therapy, you know, things may seem like they're not going well because we're opening up some wounds and some scars, and we may see some repercussions of that and some relived right. trauma. And in fact, one of our ways of, you know, we, as counselors, we have to help these patients and clients is to help them through those difficult emotions that come out when we talk about past trauma. And there are some techniques, of course, that counselors can do that. Various techniques that we would love to maybe discuss in another podcast. But, you know, it may seem like things are going worse rather than better at first, but all therapy hurts sometimes. I talk to patients too about, like, well, if you go to physio and you're, you know, for a broken leg, you're mm-hmm. going to be doing some exercises and it's going to be painful because you're breaking through some scar tissue there. Well, it's the exact same thing with psychotherapy, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's a great illustration to use. Yeah.
You've talked to us before at Smart Family Podcast about how shame can impact a marriage. And we wanted to go and probe a bit further on this whole area because, you know, there are significant ways that couples are struggling, but not really understanding what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I would say that, you know, I would put my hand up and say, well, you know, Carrie and I struggled in ways early in our marriage that where we were completely blind to the impact of our pasts. And it would have been helpful for us to have at least some window into, okay, there's, you know, there's a chance that maybe the experiences of our past are, you know, we're bringing them forward into this. What would you say are some questions that young couples or couples about to be married could ask each other about their pasts to gain insight, and in particular, you know, on as it relates to building a bond with each other?
What type of attachment did you experience growing up? That's key. Were you insecure or secure? You know, were you avoidant, anxious, or disorganized? And then I asked them, how was failure discussed in your home? When you failed, how did you deal with failure? Not conflict, but failure. There's a big difference. What thinking patterns regarding your own identity and self-worth and acceptability did you understand from these insecure attachments or secure attachments? And there are actually 18 different schemas. I also asked them, how did you process shame? I defined shame and obviously asked them how to process that shame with one another growing up. And then also, how was shame covered up? In other words, what defense mechanisms were used not to deal with things that went wrong?
Another important were used by the parent or by the individual?
By the parent, and then now by this 20-something who wants to get married. What did they see? Here's another important one. What were your family's presenting self? In other words, what strategies of impression or image management did you use to mask or cover up problems? That's a critical question. And then what hidden self do you have as a family? In other words, what issues were hidden, but everybody knew they were there? In other words, what didn't you talk about? So what did you talk about, what you wanted your world to see as a presenting self? But what didn't you talk about in terms of some biases or willful blindness? You knew that you knew that you knew, but you didn't want to talk about them. Self-defeating beliefs. What were some self-defeating beliefs? That has to do with perfectionism, to see perfectionism, performance, and approval. How did you believe that I will have value based upon those four. Those are massive.
Can I just ask you, because I think that this, there's an area that couples can really gain something from, but we need to go back there. You sure. mentioned attachment and sure. whether you're in your family as a child, your attachment was secure or insecure, or I think you said disorganized.
Yes,
disorganized. Like yeah. what, can you just break those down and how those sure. might impact a marriage?
So avoidant attachment. So every childhood attachment like has a adult counterpart. So avoidant attachment is a sense where my parents weren't necessarily bad people, but we never unpacked failure. We never unpacked emotion. As long as I was performing well and a compliant, things went well. The moment I had a problem and I want to unpack emotion, my parents kind of covered that over. So that creates an avoidant attachment where I perform well, and yet I never deal with anything. The problem is the counterpart in adulthood is called dismissive attachment. I don't get on well with people. I won't connect with my spouse. We don't talk about tough issues. I go to a vault and keep things in there, come out. I have a strong presenting self, and I can never fail. So that would be some key areas of an avoidant attachment that becomes dismissive as an adult. The anxious attachment is where mom and dad had high needs themselves. So the child clings, takes care of, fosters, is compliant, meets the needs of emotionally, but the child is still left ambivalent as to what their own issues are. Those aren't unpacked. So in other words, the stress of the child creates stress in the parent. So then the child shuts down and clings and takes care of. The problem with that is that the counterpart in adulthood is preoccupied. So the spouse then runs after the other spouse, caters to their needs, rescues and enables. As a woman, often they will give sex for love because they want to connect and be cling. But again, there's no meaningful into me see. No one's seeing into the other. And so it can create a desperation. And as a parent, they end up by enabling because they have a need to be needed by their kids. So they become child-centered. That's key. And then as disorganized is where a couple of things are happening. There's been either emotional, all types of abuse, sexual abuse, spiritual abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, etc., to the child. Or the parents abdicate their role. They pull away from being parents altogether because of their own abuse and their own trauma history. There's abuse in the home in terms of the child witnesses domestic violence, or they witness hurt. And so the child is left literally floundering, and their hippocampus is on a constant state of alert. They're waiting for something to go wrong. So they literally develop armor around themselves and nobody gets in. The problem with that is hurt people. And so they become this teenager, an adult that is reactive. So they either totally shut down and hide in, depending on personality, if they're analytical or amiable, they'll hide behind either performance or drugs, etc. Or if they're driver expressive in their personality, they'll dominate themselves or they'll attack. And so they become leaders of groups or of gangs. And if they do become a parent, they literally go from spouse to spouse to spouse to spouse. And so that's critical to grasp. And all of that you can see can be an epigenetic history, a trauma history in attachment as well.
But, just to steer us back a little bit towards the marriage relationship and maybe getting a bit more, granular on that, Craig, is, how does a relationship with, say, a mother or father influence the subsequent relationship with our spouse?
I think spouses can often trigger us. It's amazing how we can have a spouse and we're not actually upset with the spouse. We're actually upset with our parents and because they trigger something in us. And what needs to happen is that's why I really believe, even if couples never had premarital counseling, that they go back and look at marital enrichment. And they look at what traumas or abuses did each of us actually face growing up, and not pretend that didn't happen. Because believe it or not, Renee, I triggered her and she triggered me. You know, I literally triggered her as her mother hurt her, and she triggered me in terms of not wanting to deal with anything. And my mother didn't want to face anything. And so we didn't realize that this had a history behind it. So it's good to realize not blaming our parents, but going back and saying those things existed. And then we have our own stuff too, that we come with our own baggage, but we also come with ourselves. And, you know, I can create challenges in my wife. She can create challenges in me, but I need to take culpability for me because I take ownership for that. And she needs to take culpability for herself as well. So as much as there is that spillover, it's understanding what that spillover is and then working that through. This is where I think marital enrichment or counseling can really help.
So Craig, how, just in that, what you said about, you know, spouses triggering each other and, you know, that the real issue isn't each other, that there's a tie back to one's own past. Hmm. How can people discover that is actually what's going on? Like, how can you get underneath the, you know, the feeling that, okay, you are really irritating me, I'm really angry at you. How can people make the connection with what has happened in their past?
The big thing is, first of all, that both parties are looking at themselves and allowing, they create this atmosphere of acceptance where we both agree that there has been certain areas of hurt in both our past, and then we have our own dysfunction. Often the start of most discussions in marriage is adversarial or accusatory, but we have to agree that we're going to start an atmosphere of acceptance. The next is to then align with one another as to exactly what were those hurts? What have we gone through? What are we experiencing? And then here's the big one, attend. Actually attune into and attend and asking good open-ended questions to one another to try and discover the other. You know, and that actually helps in every area when I'm trying to hear what my spouse is actually experiencing and how do I contribute to that? Not that I'm a trigger for your dad or your mom, but how am I as a person being a pain? What am I doing to you?
So what would you say? Can you give us a few examples of good attending questions?
Yeah. For instance, if the spouse said, you know, you continually dominate, you say, okay, first of all, let me apologize. So you immediately become humble and teachable and acknowledge that. It's called affirming. You don't have to agree with every single thing that your spouse says to affirm, but I affirm the fact that I can be domineering and controlling. The next is, what is it about my domineering and controlling that really, does it frustrate you? Does it anger you? Let's identify a couple of the emotions of actually what it does to you at your core level. And then what values am I violating? What values do you have as a spouse? And it might be, well, I want peace. I want to be heard. I want to be understood. Okay, in what ways am I not creating peace here for you? In what ways do you not feel heard by me? How can you feel heard? What do I need to do? Well, you're not going to do it anyway. I understand that I have a track record where I haven't done that, but let's talk about how I could do that. And I think, and then asking, this is a big one, give me a list of your values and your needs. Because I want to repair damage done. And I know the bandage for that, the restoring of that, comes from me understanding you as a person. Let's look at how I can meet those needs and understand what you value, because every single conflict is a conflict over values and needs that have not been met. So those would be some critical starting points for a couple.
So Craig, how can a spouse help his or her partner who has been abused or has had a traumatic past?
Well, that's a great question. The first thing is to do is have incredible empathy towards them. Don't try fix it. Try to understand. Often it can be, especially if the spouse who has not been abused doesn't understand abuse, they may want to kind of fix that and so they can move on, but go through it with the spouse. The next thing, go together for counseling and listen to how and what the counselor is saying to the spouse that was abused And I would suggest that that spouse who wasn't abused takes notes and empathically understands what's being said. Another, if one is a Christian, pray with one's abused spouse. Seek scripture and point that that spouse back to a heavenly Father who understands, who is close to the brokenhearted and heals those who are crushed in spirit. Another is do not label a spouse. Don't talk to the spouse as an abused spouse. A spouse has been abused, but it's not a death sentence and it's not a lifetime labor. That's why I really don't like the term survivor of abuse, because it still is a label saying I can't move on. That defines who I am. I've gone through abuse. I'm not, my entire life is defined as abused.
Craig, can you say just a few words about what would you say to someone who has been carrying that label and is what, you know, that's what they've believed about themselves. What would you tell them about their identity?
I often say to people, that's so key at our identity, because often when we've been abused, that is the label we carry with ourselves. I look at my own past, my own trauma, and I constantly heard certain things in my head about certain people, and then would define myself that way. And I'll be honest, at some point, because it kind of, that's the only way I could understand myself. And then I realized, no, my identity is not the sum total of several incidences. My identity, and personally for myself, was found in God, that He's a Father. I am a child of God. And so I can find healing. And so the idea of helping the client, first of all, understand what the abuse was, and then hearing how they label themselves, listen to how they label themselves with great empathy. And go, you know, I can understand how you would see yourself as this, as a survivor of sexual abuse, for instance. But we need to refocus on what true intimacy is. So you are somebody worth loving. You are worth somebody. In fact, you are somebody who is worth dying for. Again, if they are spiritual or religious in any way, saying Jesus died for you. So you could be a daughter or son of God. Or if they're not religious, say you're a spouse. You are a mother or you are a father. You are a worker. You are a whatever their job is, their roles. You have dignity. You are not what you once were, though that did happen. And you are a perseverer. You persevere, and through resilience, you work through issues. So you are an overcomer. So you start, and again, people say, well, you're still labeling. Yeah, but it's a different label. Mm-hmm. I am an abused person. Or listen to this, I am an overcomer. I am a father or a mother. I am a son or a daughter. See, the roles are very different. It's a very different identity. Whatever I say after I am, the word I am literally means identity. So whatever I say after that, so most of us are taught, I am no good, I am useless, I am abused, I am hurt, or I am an overcomer, I am a mother or a father, I am. And so we change the word after I am is so critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it does. I like what you said about person with dignity, a person who has inherent value.
100%.
Craig, thank you so much for sharing your insights into this topic. It's a complex topic. We probably could spend a lot more time on this area. And we look forward to having further conversations in the future about this. Wow, what a great conversation with Craig once again. I just so much appreciate talking to him and with him and listening to some great advice that he has reaped over these years and years of counseling experience with couples and families. Once again, such a great conversation. Now, Tony, at the introduction there, I did divulge a little bit about my Dutch background and realized, wait a second, you've got some Dutch heritage in your family as well, because Carrie's background is Dutch as well. Did any of what I said ring true with your relationship with Carrie and how you guys relate to each other or as parents?
You can I'm laughing, and this is something that we talk about, so I'm not saying anything out of school, but basically, I don't know if you've ever heard this, Rob. It goes, wooden shoes, wooden head, wooden listen.
Oh, yes.
What are you talking about?
I say that just playfully and affectionately because I love our Dutch relatives, yes, and Carrie's Dutch background. But it's true, there is a stubborn streak and it gets passed down.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. I mean, that is such a strong genetic trait, Tony, that there's no way that'll ever be, you know, washed out in subsequent generations. I'm sorry to say.
If you have enjoyed this episode today, would you please do us a favor and share it? And if you would subscribe to our podcast, that would ensure that you never miss a single episode. Also, we're on socials on Instagram and Facebook, and please do feel free to reach out, leave us a comment. We would love to hear from you.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us today once again. Please join us again in our next episode. And we just want to so much be a resource for you and your family and in your relationships. So thanks so much for joining us today on the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home.